and welcome to The Europeans, the weekly podcast about the often joyful, sometimes depressing, but always messy and complicated continent that we call home. This is Katie, your resident reporter in Paris, and I'm speaking to... Dun, dun, dun.
Cats in Amsterdam.
What's going on? Did you kidnap Dominic?
He's gone now. He's gone to Scotland, so I'm here instead.
He's having a very British holiday in Scotland, enjoying the beautiful landscape and eating damp sandwiches on very blustery walks, and generally recharging his batteries. So I'm very happy that you're here to keep me company this week, Cats. And Wojciech will be joining me next week from Warsaw. But what's been happening over there in Amsterdam? What's Dominic missing?
Oh, the sun has finally come out and it's Yay. So nice. There's like everyone immediately jumps into the water and it's really lovely to see that.
I love the image of Amsterdammers en masse just all jumping into the water in their like work clothes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes everybody gets a little bit worried about how filthy the water probably is, but it's like just socially accepted and decided we're not going to think about that.
That's nice. We're also very fixated on water quality here in Paris because of the Olympics, which are coming, and people are supposed to be swimming in that water. So we'll see how that goes. Watch this space.
Yay. How's it been going in Paris?
Not much has been happening, to be honest. I've mostly been very fixated on the roadworks that have been happening on my corner. They've been pouring new, is it called asphalt? You know, that kind of liquid cement that makes the road?
Oh, yeah. With the like rocks in it.
Yeah. So they've been doing that. And there's a very satisfying machine that they've been rolling over this new road surface to make it nice and smooth.
Oh, to like squash it.
Yeah, to kind of squash it and smooth it all out. So I've been enjoying watching that. But even more than enjoying watching the roadworks, I've been enjoying watching the men who've been gathering to watch this machine at work. And it's only men. So like the women of my neighborhood seem to be too busy with their actual lives to stop and watch this machine. But the machine seems to turn men of all ages into little boys. And it doesn't matter if they're like late for work or to pick up the kids or whatever. They have been stopping and watching the machine. And it's really wonderful. And I was talking to a friend about this and she said, oh, did you know there is a word for this in Italian for men that stop and watch roadworks?
No way.
Yes way. The word is umarel. I think it's like a dialect word from Bologna.
Okay.
And I think it's supposed to refer more specifically to old men looking at roadworks and usually old men who give unsolicited advice to the workers about how to do their jobs.
Katie, are you one of them?
I think I'm one of them. I've become an umarel. But I just love that this word exists and it made me wonder what people's favourite words in their own languages are that should exist in other languages but don't.
That is incredible. And a really good example, like sometimes people in Holland love to say that gezellig doesn't exist and I'm always like, come on, it's basically cozy. But this is like very particular and we definitely do not have a word for it. I love it.
Very, very particular. I would love to hear your favourite words that exist in your languages that should exist in all languages. Send them in. hello@europeanspodcast.com.
Apparently there's a word in Norway for a large pile of small rocks.
A large pile of small rocks.
This is something I learned in a bar once. Please tell me if it's true.
Damn, this feels like something we should have asked this week's guest.
So who are we talking to later?
Yeah, so coming up in a bit, we have an interview with one of the co-hosts of a fascinating podcast in which a Swede, a Norwegian and a Dane all talk to each other in their own languages. It's described as Scandinavian family therapy. I love this idea and I was so intrigued to hear how it works in practice. So stay tuned for that excellent interview coming up with Hilda Sandvik. But first, it is a nature-themed edition of Good Week, Bad Week. Good week, bad week. Who's had a good week, Kat?
It's been pretty big good news this week. It is good news for the natural world. Millions of insects, plants, and animals. I think we sometimes forget, but we are also animals. Mm-hmm. But last week, the much contested and very exciting EU Nature Restoration Law was passed.
Yay! Plot twist. We all thought it was dead. Before we get into this, can you give us a reminder? What actually is this law? What does it involve us doing?
Yeah, you've probably seen the name of this law pass by in the news, but to give you a bit more detail, it's this EU law that requires all member states to restore 20% of their natural areas by 2030, so that's land and sea, and to restore all ecosystems by 2050, which is pretty significant because 80% of European natural landscapes are in poor condition. And this is also really quite a historical moment in that we are moving on from not just conserving and protecting, but actually restoring nature. And so we're recognizing that actively rewilding, essentially, is a part of our environmental policy that we're going to need. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of reasons to be excited, but in classic European style, I should add the caveat that this law came under quite a lot of fire in the recent months and was watered down rather substantially.
Why was it so controversial in the first place?
Yes, I think generally there's been growing backlash against environmental policy in the EU, and the centre-right EPP in particular came out against this law, as well as a chunk of Renew Europe, the Liberal Party of the EU. And one factor has been the farmers' protests we talked about a few weeks ago already on the show. Mm-hmm. A section of these farmers were not pleased with the nature restoration law. And I will say this is not all farmers. And environmental groups have emphasized that this nature restoration is not at odds with farming because fundamentally it's essential to farming. I was actually at a farming conference this weekend, and a lot of farmers there were talking about how these nature areas are essential to them because farming depends on things like pollinators.
Right.
So a lack of biodiversity is a problem for them too. Something that I've been wanting to talk about on the show for ages is this year has been absolutely brutal because of a huge explosion in the slug population. Me and Dominic talk about this on the regular because we both have little gardens.
Yeah, listeners, just to clarify, Katz and Dominic will not shut up about the slugs. Feel very strongly that slugs should take a central role in this podcast. So I'm glad, Katz, that you found a way to talk about them finally.
It's crazy. There is truly an insane quantity of slugs. And I initially just thought like, is this just my garden? What is this? But it is bigger and it's so intense that people at this conference were actually talking about vegetables getting really expensive potentially at the end of this summer.
Because of the slugs?
Yeah, exactly. Because they're eating all of the seedlings. Huh. And this is just like one thing. And it does have to do with our changing climate, like warmer winters, a very wet spring. But also we've killed off a lot of our slug predators, birds and hedgehogs. And so our ecosystems are a lot less resilient to these kinds of changes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's about a lot more than slugs, this law. Nonetheless, there is also a large portion of farmers who are worried that this law will make their already challenging lives a lot harder. And Brussels has been trying to keep friendly with these farmers. Nonetheless, a watered-down form of this law has made it all the way past the Parliament, the Commission, and now this final step last week. Also, the Council has approved it.
The Council being like national governments, right?
Yeah.
And you said it's been watered down. In what ways has this law been watered down since the original version that was on the table?
Yeah, so for one, there's been a clause added that adds an emergency break, so that requirements for the farming sector can be suspended under exceptional circumstances that would pose a threat to food security. Of course, it remains to be seen how strict countries will be on when they call something a special circumstance, and failing crops are just an inherent part of farming, only more so with climate change. So people are worried that adding in these loopholes will really make it quite vulnerable. Another thing is that there were a lot more obligations in the original version requiring states to not only restore this 20% now, but actively fight deterioration in the areas that they will need to restore next. So all of those areas for 2050, which makes sense because the more deteriorated those areas are, the less likely that it'll even be possible to reach those future goals. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I get shocked like every time I write the date, but we're already in 2024. Like 2030 is so close and 2050 is also not that far away if you consider how quickly things are moving in terms of our changing environment.
Okay, thank you for that doom and gloom.
But sorry, it's very exciting, Katie.
But on the brighter side, we do actually have a version of this law now, which we should celebrate, you know, like we should take wins when they come. How did we actually go from the situation where it felt like this law was basically dead to, da-da, surprise, this is happening?
Yeah, so for context, things were pretty tense because in the past 5 years of the EU, we've had a parliament and a commission and a council that, I mean, obviously they have their conflicts, but on the whole, they've collaborated to make some kind of Green Deal. Mm-hmm. But with the last election, the big surge of far right means we can expect new climate policy to be significantly less ambitious or less likely to pass. So the upcoming term is going to be quite different. So this meeting last Monday was really the last moment for this constellation of the EU to come together and pass this nature restoration law, or not. Needless to say, more than a few people were gritting their teeth and curious about what would happen. So then last Monday, the council comes together for this final step. That is the environmental minister of each of the member states. And for the law to pass, they need 65% approval. But so far, too many countries have been voting against it. The Netherlands, Finland, Hungary, Poland, Sweden, Italy, and then also Austria and Slovakia. Which I will say is rather shameful, because in all of these countries, more than 70% of their citizens did support the law. So this really is a case of the government going against the wishes of their citizens. So Monday comes along, the Austrian environmental minister, Leonor Gewessler, she comes out and she votes for the Nature Restoration Act. And people say that also triggered Slovakia to vote in favor. And that is what pushed the vote over the edge. They had more than 65% and the law passed.
It feels quite momentous. But what made the Austrian minister change her mind?
So this was really quite a bold move, and also a rather dramatic and confusing one. Because while the news was rolling out of like, hooray, the nature law has been passed, momentous occasion, there was also all of this news that the Austrian chancellor had accused his environmental minister of going rogue, abusing her power by illegally voting, and that she would be facing criminal charges.
Oh, shit.
I know. Can you imagine being a Gewessler and like going into Luxembourg that day and being like, well, I hope I get away with this.
What happens in Luxembourg, right?
Exactly.
But did she have the right to do what she did and to say, like, I represent Austria, I'm voting for this, and like, this has to stand if I vote for it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I should stress that as much as I love the image of her like spontaneously going rogue, it was a much more weighed out decision. And the answer to your question is really more about Austrian domestic politics. Clearly, the Austrian chancellor does think that she abused her power. But there is a law that says that the federal regions of Austria must come up with a consensus position on environmental laws. And if they can't, then it's up to the federal minister, which is Gewessler, to make a decision. Up until right before the vote, all of the Austrian federal regions were in a consensus against the nature restoration law. But last minute, Vienna changes their mind. And Gewessler argues that means that she is allowed to vote as she did.
All right, because all of the regions are now in disagreement. So it's her job to step in and say, I'm going to make a position for all of us.
And that's what she says. But obviously, the chancellor does not agree. She also says that a few weeks earlier, the centre-right agricultural minister did exactly the same, striking down a policy that she asked him not to. But I couldn't find any reporting on whether that was the same legal situation. And well, who is right? That'll be argued out in the Austrian courts. But in the meantime, the EU has decided that the vote holds and we are keeping the nature restoration law.
Has the Austrian environment minister surfaced since she did this rogue move? Have we heard from her since?
She's put out a bunch of like thank you videos for all of her support on Instagram and on Twitter. And generally, she seems pretty cool about it. And she continues to say that she's had plenty of legal advice, she's not breaking the law, and she's not worried about criminal charges. She did also put out a statement saying, in 20 or 30 years, when I talk to my two nieces and show them the beauty of our country and of this continent, and they ask me, what did you do when everything was at stake? I want to be able to tell them I tried to support as much as I could.
That's very sweet.
Yeah, and it does give me goosebumps also to realize that like this kind of dramatic telenovela level we are reaching as we continue to postpone adequate action in the face of this huge climate crisis. Like, this is the point we've reached. And in defense of her career savviness, she was likely to lose her job soon anyway because of upcoming elections. And some say this move is actually an excellent election campaign because she is a candidate in the next ones.
And she's a green politician, right? So this is really going to boost her credentials.
Exactly. So for anyone who is thinking, yes, please do take bolder steps, this is a pretty good campaign start. Amazingly, in the meantime, in spite of all of this drama, she is still the environmental minister and the coalition has not fallen.
Kind of love that. Conflict resolution. Let's get through this together as an Austrian government.
I love that too. I would love to sit in these meetings and just see what it's like, but hey. So drama or no drama, the coalition still stands, the nature law still stands, and here we are. It's really a reason to celebrate.
It really is. I will dampen that by saying it does make me feel sort of anxious because this is a law that I like. I'm very comfortable with the Austrian environment minister having gone rogue on it. And it's very easy for me to see her as a kind of rebellious hero.
Mm.
But if this happens again, and it's a case of, I don't know, like a far-right minister helping to get like a really, really anti-immigration law passed for the whole of the EU, I might feel very differently about it.
Yeah, I thought that too. And like, I love the story of her going rogue. It's like a funny and exciting story as someone who's really worried about the climate crisis. But I was slightly reassured to hear that she does seem to have somewhat of a legal argument that this was not going rogue completely. And I do hope that that remains true as this court case unfolds, because it is a bit scary for democracy if we're just on the loose.
Maybe Austria will change its rules after this.
We shall see. Who has had a bad week?
I am giving bad week to pigeons. How do you feel about pigeons?
I mostly spell the word pigeon wrong all the time. I just really think it should have a D in it.
It is spelt wrong in English, I agree.
Other than that, my feelings are mixed.
I don't know. I have a sort of weird affection for them. They're not very beloved, but they are sort of greedy but harmless. So I feel a real affinity for them. They are, of course, also an extremely familiar presence in many European cities.
Mm.
So much so that we literally featured some kissing pigeons on our new website, europeanspodcast.com. They're on the episodes page if you'd like to see them. But yeah, why am I talking about pigeons? It is because of a rather startling referendum that took place in Germany. It was actually a couple of weeks back, on the same day, in fact, as the European elections in Germany. But suffice to say that this pigeon referendum has generated almost as much angst and drama as the European elections. And the fallout from this referendum is very much continuing to resonate. So I figured we could still talk about it. In this referendum, residents in the West German town of Limburg an der Lahn were given a vote on whether to kill all of the pigeons in the town. All of them.
What? So that is madness!
And in perhaps a sign of just how underloved pigeons are, 53% of the people who voted to kill the pigeons.
Oh my God, that is so dark.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't be laughing. It's awful.
Awful, but absurd at the same time.
Okay, but hang on. Why were people given the option to vote on this in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, the first thought that struck me was this is a really good example of why in a functioning democracy, there are certain things that shouldn't be decidable by a majority. Minority rights being one of those things, specifically the rights of pigeons.
I would argue there might be more pigeons than us. I'm not sure it's a minority situation.
It is a minority. I have some figures that I'm going to tell you in a second.
Oh, tell me.
There are more of us than the pigeons. But yeah, sometimes the voting people are not very nice. And I spent quite a lot of time looking around online trying to find good reasons why people might want to kill all of the pigeons in a town. In Limburg, the best reason that I could find was that people, and especially restaurant owners and market vendors, were sick of having to clear up lots of pigeon droppings around Neumarkt, which is the big town square, which doesn't, to me, justify like local mass killing of pigeons. But what do I know? I'm not a restaurant owner in Limburg. I also tried to figure out if there is a disproportionately high number of pigeons in Limburg. But it doesn't seem crazy to me. There are definitely way more people than pigeons. According to my own calculations, there are about 0.02 pigeons per capita in Limburg, which is half the number of pigeons per capita that we have here in Paris. And you don't see us Parisians voting to kill them all. But to give you some context about how this referendum ended up happening, Limburg's war on the pigeons is not new. And the local authorities there have been trying various means of trying to keep the pigeon population under control for decades. Since 2000, they'd been catching pigeons and releasing them far away. Just make them someone else's problem. It's fine. But that had become too expensive. The problem apparently got worse during COVID because there was quite a lot of takeaway food rubbish left in open garbage bins. And so fast forward to last November, the local council took a pretty radical decision. it decided that a pest control person should be allowed to kill the pigeons, and in quite a drastic way. So the pigeons would be lured into a kind of big pigeon house from which there was no escape. They would be stunned, and then their necks would be broken by this pest control person.
Oh, gruesome.
I don't know. I mean, advocates of this idea were like, it's actually kinder to the pigeons to reduce their population because there isn't enough food for them in the town. So they're all bedraggled and undernourished. And they argued, you know, this is a fairly humane way to kill them, even if it sounds quite shocking. Animal rights activists obviously reacted completely differently. They were like, this is insane. None of this is necessary. What are we doing here? The whole situation started gathering national attention in Germany, and the city council ended up having to hold a special session under police protection because apparently anti-pigeon councillors had been receiving quite violent messages from animal rights activists, and they decided to put this policy to a referendum. That referendum took place a couple of weeks back, and lo and behold, the people voted by a small majority, 53%, to kill Limburg's pigeon population. As far as I can work out, it would be any pigeon that is caught. And that would happen over the course of 2 years.
Wow. But like, given all of this major backlash, is this actually going to go forward?
I'm not sure that anyone's thought ahead that far. I mean, the mayor has said that this decision is binding and that, you know, for people to have faith in democracy, it has to go forward. Mm. But as of last Thursday, the town officials were still trying to decide whether to actually go ahead with this, according to an interview that a spokesman for the town, Johannes Laubach, gave to the Associated Press. And it does seem like before anything can happen, there needs to be a new census of the town's pigeon population to confirm that there is indeed still a big population that, quote unquote, needs to be killed. At the last count, there were 700. Presumably, if that has gone down massively, the town would rethink the policy.
It's also quite arbitrary, no? Like, ah, yes, this number means we do need to kill them all. Like,
well, exactly.
This town isn't sealed off. And I always think, like, if we could easily reduce pigeons' population, then we would have. Like, is this actually going to work? Can you kill off all the pigeons in your town?
This is the thing. I haven't been able to find an expert who said, oh, yeah, this is a really good solution that's going to work. I actually spoke on background with a European bird expert who told me, quote, it's quite clear that culling is at best a short-term solution and at worst a waste of money. They said, pigeons breed very fast, so if they have food, they will build back their population basically as fast as the killing effort. I was actually reading in Euronews that there was an attempted cull of pigeons in Basel in Switzerland between 1961 and 1985, so quite a long period of time. The city killed around 100,000 pigeons a year during this time.
Oh my God.
And get this, the population remained stable during that time.
Incredible. The pigeons fight back.
The pigeons fight back. Then, interestingly, in Basel, they changed the policy. They started focusing a lot more on pushing a public education campaign of please don't feed the pigeons, as well as taking the pigeons' eggs away when they found them.
Wait, does that mean like people not throwing like bags of seed, or does that mean like not leaving food around?
Probably both, I would guess. But lo and behold, after 4 years, the population of pigeons had fallen 50%, which is pretty impressive. Longer term, though, from what I've read, this model of pigeon control, which is called the Basel model, hasn't been that successful. And actually, there are a bunch of different cities around Europe trying out different methods to reduce their pigeon populations, none of which seems to be working perfectly. So in the UK, there are some cities that have brought in birds of prey to hunt the pigeons,
wow,
which is maybe a more kind of natural pro-biodiversity solution.
What kind of birds hunt the pigeons?
Hawks, I believe, like peregrine falcons and Harris hawks. But it does mean that there are pigeon carcasses scattered around the place, which isn't very nice. Several German cities, including Frankfurt, are using something called the Augsburg model, which is where you catch pigeons in dove houses and nurse them back to health if necessary. You also feed them with proper bird food rather than kebabs and French fries. But you replace any eggs that you find with fake ones. So the mama pigeons continue to sit on these eggs, but they never hatch, thereby reducing the population. That sounds a lot nicer, but from what I've read, it also seems to have had only limited success so far.
And then you've got a bunch of fake pigeon eggs lying around.
Yeah, exactly. So the jury's still out on how to actually reduce a pigeon population in a way that is both humane and effective. But the experts are pretty much in agreement that this cull in Limburg is not going to work.
Okay, so it's just purposeless violence.
Purposeless violence. A nice title for this week's podcast episode.
As ridiculous as this sounds, it's also incredibly cruel. Like, is there actually any kind of serious harm that pigeons are causing to our lives?
Not really. I mean, they can carry diseases like other birds, mites and that kind of thing. The main complaint against them, though, seems to be that their droppings cause damage to buildings.
I had two summers where pigeons nested on my balcony and it was like absolutely wild. I think the whole summer long I didn't sleep for like more than 4 hours a night because they were just cooing all the time and the quantity of droppings they produced was insane. But
oh, really?
Still, I mean, this level of murder, I think even in my like crazy sleep deprived state at that time, I wouldn't have gone to such lengths.
I mean, the good news for the pigeons of Limburg is that several German animal rights organizations have said that they will launch legal action against the town council if they actually go ahead with this. There was actually a legal report commissioned a few years ago by animal welfare officers in Berlin that suggested that legally, if something like this went to court, it might actually be found that the state has a duty to care for pigeons. Because I don't know how widely known this is, but pigeons were originally domesticated animals. So the fact that they exist as like a massive undernourished population in the wild, it's kind of our fault as humans.
Of course, because they were like our post service.
Exactly, yeah. Very clever animals.
We've stayed so much nicer to horses than pigeons.
Right. Anyway, it's still very much up in the air, if you'll excuse the bird pun, what's actually going to happen to these pigeons. I do think the likelihood of this cull happening has been reduced by the fact that there has been a national outcry in Germany over this, and actually even an international outcry. This story made it onto The Late Show in the US this week.
Hey, Germany. You okay?
But watch this space. We'll bring you important pigeon updates as they land.
Yes, please.
Just to make things even more depressing after talking about mass pigeon killings, I was listening to a very good interview on the podcast Search Engine the other day about just how important it is that we support small, independent media projects that are doing good work if we enjoy living in a democracy and we want to stay living in a democracy. It sounds a bit melodramatic, but it's really true. You know, our media system is broken, and the kind of journalism that is important really doesn't get the funding that it needs to do a good job, which is where we come in and where you come in. If you care about journalism that treats Europe as a single space and makes it feel accessible and even enjoyable, we would love it if you could send a little bit of cash our way so that we can keep doing what we're doing. And I'll put a link to that interview that I just mentioned in the show notes, because in that interview, the journalist Ezra Klein makes a much more eloquent case than me for why it is so important to support small media projects that you love.
I've been listening to this too, actually, and there's like a variety of really good interviews about our media system. I really enjoyed them.
It's such a good show.
You can send as little as €3 a month our way via our Patreon page. And every person that does really is helping us to do this quietly important thing each week. And with that in mind, we would like to thank our latest supporters, Kai, Maya, Yasna, and Bernd. Thank you all so much. You can join these wonderful people at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. It's interview time. Katie, who did you talk to this week?
So we are speaking to a very interesting person that our producer, Wojciech, met at a journalism conference in Bergen in Norway very recently. That person is the Norwegian journalist Hilde Sandvik. And as soon as we heard about her podcast, we were like, we have to speak to Hilde on the show and hear more about this because it is fascinating. You know, people often ask us, how do you guys at the Europeans make a podcast about a continent that speaks so many different languages? And the answer is that we make this podcast in English, which for better or worse has become the main working language for Europeans trying to communicate with each other. On Hilde's podcast, which she co-hosts with Åsa Linderborg from Sweden and Hassan Pressler from Denmark, these three Scandinavians speak their own languages, Norwegian, Swedish, and Danish, with each other. And that does not stop them from having great conversations about all kinds of things. I loved this idea for a podcast, and so I was very happy to join Wojciech and Hilda to hear all about it. Hilda, thank you so much for joining us.
It's really such a pleasure to be here.
From one cross-border podcast to another.
Yes, definitely.
Could you explain to our listeners in a nutshell what your podcast is and how it came about?
Yeah, it's a podcast with me. I am a Norwegian. It's a Danish person and a Swedish person who joins in. It's called Norsken, Svensken or Dansken, which means literally the Norwegian, the Swede and the Dane. And every week we talk about what has happened in our own countries, but also across borders, and we can whistleblow on our own countries even. And we call it Pan-Scandinavian Family Therapy. And it is, you know, the Scandinavians are like siblings. And we tended to be siblings who had outgrown each other, or we were not particularly interested in each other. But what I thought at some point, I was a culture editor, debate editor in the west part of Norway in Bergen. And I thought we really need some more oxygen into our own public spheres, because we tend to be so running around our own issues and we talk about the same things and with the same people. And then it was like, when you go to a funeral and then you meet relatives, you haven't spoken to them for a while and you think, ah, they're quite interesting. Let's get to know each other again. And that was the sense, putting siblings together in a room who hadn't been talking so much with each other for a long while. And then magic happened.
And just to clarify, you all speak your own languages, right?
Yeah, we do. I speak Norwegian. The Swedish person, she used to be a culture editor in Aftonbladet in Sweden. And the Dane, he is a director, actor, writer, and he speaks Danish.
So I'm wondering how central to the whole idea is this multilingual aspect. Do you think people will listen if you spoke English?
To be honest, no, I don't think so. And that's very interesting. One of the few times we actually get criticized for the language is when one of us use English, because people don't want that. It's like you look upon you as a kind of a vulgar person using English all the time. Mm-hmm. There was a woman that she was stalking me whenever I used an English phrase. Sometimes we try to explain to each other because we can bump into some words or phrases that are really so unfamiliar, you don't really understand what's going on. And then we switch to English. But then listeners don't like that. And I also think it's about identity, actually, because when I speak English, I get to be some other kind of person, another kind of personality. So it's also connected to that, I think.
How mutually intelligible are the three languages? I mean, I asked a Norwegian friend about this podcast and she said, it's so interesting, but how the hell do the other two understand the Danish person was her question.
Of course, we have to constantly bear in mind that people can have problems with each other's languages, because of course we know each other so well now that I understand everything very easily, but we need to slow down from time to time. And there are also words in Danish, which means total opposite in Norwegian, for instance. And there are Swedish words, which when you use it, you can immediately jump into some very big and insulting misunderstandings. But that is also funny, because then we can stop up and we can say, what word is that? Can you explain? Where does it come from? So that's also the part of getting to know each other very closely, I would say. And that was my aim, actually, why this came about. And for me, there was also another reason, that is that we live in a world right now where it's very important to know your neighbor, and it's getting more and more important. So then we also need to understand each other's languages.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of content, do you cover mostly issues related to Scandinavia, or is the scope more general?
We start with the Scandinavian public sphere, I would say. So that means that when we also discuss the war in Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, American election, then we focus on how do we talk about these matters in Norway? Why is it that the war in Gaza is slightly differently described in Denmark and Norway, for instance? Mm. So that is also a way of getting to know how the debates are working. But we also run into difficulties on that because there are slight differences also between how much you can say about an issue in each of our countries. There are things that are hard to talk about in Sweden.
Can you give an example of one of those issues?
For a very long time, huge problems with immigration in Sweden were not discussed. I mean, you had more and more problems around the big cities, had parallel society growing up, and the Swedes did not want to talk about it. They didn't want to voice it, to be afraid of being accused of being racists. However, I think these are societal issues we need to discuss very broadly and very open-minded. I think public sphere, the journalists, the media in Sweden, the cultural sector in Sweden, understand that they should have been very much open talking about issues much, much earlier, because things tend to grow out of hand. And now you have shootings in Sweden on the highest level in Europe, and they couldn't talk about it for a long time. Or they talked about it, but they didn't voice where does this come from.
And you mentioned that, you know, you've got some angry emails from people complaining about the moments when you speak English. How otherwise have people reacted to the podcast?
What we actually see is that there is a growing interest for the issues we talk about. Of course, I cannot say that this is only due to us, but I see that the main papers in Norway, for instance, write much more about what is happening in Sweden and Denmark. NRK put back their Nordic correspondent after we started. And it seems as if there is a new emerging interest, also due to the fact that Sweden joined NATO, of course, which means that we need to cooperate on a political level also much more closely than we have for a long time.
So my sense is that outside Scandinavia, people tend to think about the Scandic nations as really brother nations that love each other. But are there any historical grudges that these nations hold against each other?
Yeah, of course, we have a very different historical background. Norway was colonized by the Danes for 400 years. We've also been part of Sweden. Both Sweden and Denmark had colonies. And of course, Sweden is the biggest country among us and also look upon itself as a kind of the big brother. And the Swedes look upon Norwegians as sweet. However, we have the oil. So we have become these nouveau riche bastards, which is sometimes very embarrassing from a Norwegian perspective. So we talk about all these matters also. And also, of course, there are also other serious dilemmas and interesting facts. What did we do during Second World War, for instance? The Swedes were so-called neutral. We were occupied. And the Swedes let Germany walk their soldiers through the country on the way to Norway. However, after the war, of course, the help that the Norwegians got from Sweden is also substantial. So there are all kinds of these stories and crossing lines and traits that also make us closer to each other, I would say.
You know, obviously Scandinavia is not the only region where people speak similar languages. And I remember we discussed this during the conference, whether you think that there are other places in Europe where such a format could actually work. So could you tell us about this?
Yeah, I mean, you can start with the simplest one. England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland could and should probably have a pan-English podcast. Yeah, and then you could say, I mean, why not do something like this between Austria, Germany, and Switzerland? Or, I mean, Belgium, the Netherlands. I mean, there are lots of places, Slovakia, Czech, the former Yugoslavian speak almost the same language. And I think what happens when you open up these cross-border conversations is that it's also, yeah, it brings more oxygen into your own talks about things nationally, but it also opens up for funny little sharings, and to compare each other is very often a funny little game that you can play. So that's some of the areas. What do you think?
I mean, I would love to hear the Irish, Scottish and English ones where people have really thick accents. I would listen to that all the time.
It's crazy that hasn't happened already, actually. It's a great idea for a podcast between the four nations of the UK.
Yes.
Maybe I'll make this happen.
Yeah.
Let's make a spin-off.
Yeah.
We can put it into a format and spread it.
Great business idea. I love this idea of Hilda's podcast as being group therapy for Scandinavians. I'm so jealous that I don't speak any of those languages so that I can listen in.
I know, I wish. And I also just think it's such a lovely idea that people are just talking their languages at each other and it works.
I do know some couples who do this.
I actually do that, but it's in languages that we both speak.
I think it's really nice.
Yeah.
Thank you so much to Hilda for joining us. Along with making this excellent podcast, she is one of the board members of an initiative called Nord 55, which is about trying to bring people across the Nordic region together for public debate. We will put a link for that in the show notes. And it goes without saying that if you are lucky enough to be a speaker of Swedish, Norwegian, and or Danish, you will, of course, find a link to Hilda's podcast in the show notes too. It's time to head to the Inspiration Station. What have you been enjoying this week, Kat?
I'm going to also use this opportunity to discuss slugs.
Have you got a podcast about slugs for us?
Exactly. Launching soon. Please donate to my Patreon. I watched like one funny Instagram video about slugs and continue to just exclusively get slug content. But my favorite is this, they're in Belgium, but I don't know where they're from, a gardener who operates under the handle Garden to Grill. Mm-hmm. And he makes these really funny videos that are like about realistic gardening. And he just makes like compilations of like, these are the four mistakes that I made that led to my slug invasion, and just like these really satirical videos about like everything's going great and then it's just like all kinds of dead plants that have been munched on, and I'm really enjoying it. So I will share a link to that in the show notes for any gardening listeners or people who just like slug content.
Which is a huge audience, I'm sure.
It really is. Lean in, Katie.
I'm skeptical. I really like this style of influencer that is not about trying to pretend that your life is perfection, but is like, I'm learning in public doing this thing that I'm enthusiastic about, but not necessarily an expert at. I think it's lovely.
Yeah, me too. I find it genuinely healing to be seeing all these people who are not pretending to be perfect and happy and beautiful all the time, but just like, it's much more realistic. So I think that's the only kind of social media I want, please.
Nice. What's his handle again?
Garden to Grill.
Garden to Grill.
What have you been enjoying, Katie? Is it also slug related?
It's not slug related. It's actually Scandinavia related. I've gone back to the interview for inspiration here, and I thought I'd bring you a regionally appropriate recommendation, and that is the Netflix miniseries Midsummer Night. Have you watched it?
I haven't.
So I'm three episodes in and I'm enjoying it very much. It's a Norwegian kind of comedy drama about Midsummer, which is a festival celebrated across Scandinavia. The date is slightly different from country to country, but it's around the summer solstice. So around now, actually. Happy Midsummer to all those who are celebrating. And again, the traditions are a little bit different from country to country. But generally, the festivities involve being outside with a big group of family, there's probably a bonfire, you might put a wreath of flowers on your head, and maybe or maybe not drink large quantities of alcohol. That is definitely a feature of this show. The series takes place over one midsummer night in the beautiful Norwegian countryside, although some of the characters are Swedish. And its characters are a family who are getting drunker and drunker over the course of this celebration. And as they're doing that, secrets are coming out.
Ooh, juicy.
Yeah, it is. I'm sure there's a ton of nuance that I'm missing watching this show as a non-Scandinavian. But I am really enjoying watching this family drama unfold and these little glimpses into tradition in a very beautiful Norwegian setting. I would describe this show as a good lunch watch.
Lunch TV, Katie.
I know, I should be going outside enjoying the beautiful summer weather.
What a terrible influence.
But if you, like me, are instead still hunched over your screen this lunchtime, check out Midsummer Night. I think it's a really good option for a lunchtime watch.
I will say that that's one of my favorite human traits as a species I sometimes have trouble with, that we have these like really ancient traditions of doing things like celebrating the longest day, like, ooh, it's really long, let's make a party.
Yeah, we've been doing this for thousands of years. I think it's nice. But yeah, I'm enjoying the show a lot. It's very funny at times, quite moving at others. It's often got an enjoyable soap opera feel to it. So yeah, check it out if that sounds like your kind of thing. It is called Midsummer Night and it is on Netflix. Happy ending time. Are you taking Dominic's job of giving us a happy ending this week, Katz?
I am, to fill in the impossibly large shoes of Dominic. I am going to close off this nature-themed episode to share that one of the oldest penguins in the world, Windy, the 30-year-old great-great-great-grandma penguin and resident of an English zoo, has hatched an egg with what the internet are calling her toy boy lover.
Yes!
Who is a sprightly 26 years her junior.
Oh, love this. Go, Windy.
This is her lover's first egg. In a statement from the zoo, the senior bird keeper, Dan Trevelyan, says, Windy was paired up with male penguin Jet for a long time, and they produced more than 20 chicks together. When Windy lost her partner, we didn't necessarily expect her to pair up with another penguin. But Nacho started courting Windy last year, and the two have been devoted to each other ever since. They had a clutch of eggs last spring, but neither of them were successful, so we're really happy that the pair now have a healthy chick that is thriving this breeding season. So special congratulations to Windy and Nacho for your steamy love affair.
I love this so much. Oh, thank you for joining me this week, Katz. This has been fun.
Yeah, it was nice to join you on the show again.
Dominic is being very lazy and taking a 2-week holiday. Can you believe it? Mm. So next week, I'm going to be joined by our other producer, Wojciech, and I'm very much looking forward to speaking to him too. In the meantime, come and visit our beautiful website, complete with pigeons on it. We're very proud of it, europeanspodcast.com.
You can also find us on the sinking ship of X, formerly known as Twitter, at europeanspod. And you can find us on Instagram at europeanspodcast. And then we're lurking on Mastodon and Blue Sky and all kinds of other things. You can find us there too.
We'll see you next week, everyone.
Bye.
Cheers.